who show the path of danger. Patatam, themselves falling. Tamasi, in darkness. He, indeed. Adaha, down. Yea, anyone who. Satadyuhu, place faith in. Vajaha, the words. Te, they. By, indeed. Majanti, sink. Ashma plavaha, boats made of stone. Iva, like. Translation, leaders who have fallen into ignorance and who mislead people by directing them to the path of destruction, as described in the previous verse, are, in effect, boarding a stone boat, and so too are those who blindly follow them. A stone boat would be unable to float and would sink in the water with its passengers. Similarly, those who mislead people go to hell, and their followers go with them. So you can repeat. Leaders who have fallen into ignorance, and who mislead people by directing them to the path of destruction, as described in the previous verse, are in effect boarding a stone boat. And so too are those who blindly follow them. A stone boat would be unable to float and would sink in the water with its passengers. Similarly, those who mislead people go to hell. And their followers go with them. So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. As stated in the Vedic literature, in the Srimad Bhagavatam 11th canto, 20th chapter, text 17, Rideham hajam sulabham sudulabham plavam sukopam guru karnadaram. We, the conditioned souls, have fallen in the ocean of nations. But the human body fortunately provides us a good opportunity to cross the ocean because the human body is like a very good boat. When directed by a spiritual master acting as the captain, the boat can very easily cross the ocean. Furthermore, the boat is helped across by favorable winds, which are the instructions of Vedic knowledge. If one does not take advantage of all these facilities to cross the ocean of nescience, he is certainly committing suicide. One who boards a boat made of stone is doomed. To be elevated to the stage of perfection, humanity must first give up false leaders who present boats of stone. All of human society is in such a dangerous position that to be rescued, it must abide by the standard instructions of the Vedas. The cream of these instructions appears in the form of Bhagavad Gita. One should not take shelter of any other instructions, for Bhagavad Gita gives direct instructions on how to fulfill the aim of human life. Lord Sri Krishna therefore says, Sarva dharmam parityaja mam ekam sharanam braja. Give up all other processes of religion and simply surrender to me. Even if one does not accept Lord Krishna as the Supreme Personality Godhead, his instructions are so exalted and beneficial for humanity that if one follows his instructions, one will be saved. Otherwise, one will be cheated by unauthorized meditation and gymnastic methods of yoga. Thus, one will board a boat of stone, which will sink and drown all its passengers. Unfortunately, although the American people are extremely eager to get out of materialistic chaos, they are sometimes found to patronize the makers of stone boats. That will not help them. They must take the proper boat offered by Krishna in the form of the Krishna Consciousness Movement. Then they will be easily saved. In this regard, Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments, Ashma maya bravo kisham teyata majjantam tavam. Anumajanti Tateti Raja Nich Yupadeshtri Shu Swasa Vyeshu Kopo Avyanjitaha. If society is guided by political diplomacy, with one nation maneuvering against another, it will certainly sink like a stone boat. Political maneuvering and diplomacy will not save human society. People must take to Krishna consciousness to understand the aim of life, to understand God, and to fulfill the human mission. So, Tesham kupata jishtrinam patatam tamas siyataha ye shatad yur vachaste vai majant jasma plavagiva. So, Om Gana, Timidanda Shag, Ananjana, Shlakaya Chachu, and Meditan, Yena Tismai, Shikurvay Namaha. So it is actually quite surprising that people who follow someone, they go to hell with the person who goes to hell too. You know, generally, before I joined the Krishna Conscious Movement, I thought, well, if someone misleads me, they actually suffer, but you know, I'm just an innocent victim of this whole affair. And in general, in Kali Yuga, as stated in the Vedic literatures, Kalo Shudra Sambhava, that everyone is Shudra. And so what does Shudra mean? Of course, one definition of Shudra Prabhupada gave is that someone who laments. That's interesting. Because that's why you see a lot of depression nowadays. Anyway. So, but basically it means someone who's controlled by the mode of ignorance. Lamentation, hankering, intoxication, you know, all these different factors are just concomitant factors with this age. And you practically everybody, if you want to go to a restaurant, you have to drink liquor or wine or something like that. Everything is based on mode of ignorance, or the sporting games, just like recently you had your World Cup. I don't know if any of you heard about this, which is, you know, some soccer. Americans are not so expert at soccer, but they're getting into it now. And so it's just like an ignorant activity, just football or, you know, even baseball, even like golf. Prabhupada was riding a car, and they were riding past a golf course, and Prabhupada asked, what is that? Because at that time they didn't have golf in India. Now they do. Now even they have so much golf in India, there's a place right next to where I stay in Govardhan. It's called Radha Golf. Can you imagine that? Radha's golf course. And the people from Delhi are coming out to play golf alongside Govardhan. So, anyway, so Prabhupada drove by this golf course, and Prabhupada said, what is that? And the devotee said, it's golf. Prabhupada said, what is that golf? And Prabhupada said, the devotee said, they are taking a stick, you know, a club, and keep hitting the ball until it goes into a hole. And whoever hits the ball the least times wins. Which is true. That's actually the definition of golf. And Prabhupada said, they're simply trying to forget Krishna. It's an interesting commentary on golf. So that commentary can also be made in regard to practically any type of sporting activity. Prabhupada sometimes equated sporting activities with the breaking of that regulated principle. You know, no gambling. Why no gambling? Because even if you don't gamble, you're wasting, you're gambling your human form of life in a time which can never be retrieved. So, of course, I'm not decrying sporting activities. Sporting activities can sometimes be utilized to keep one's body and soul together. But one doesn't have to maximize those things. Or as team building things, or with children, you know, to encourage them to be part of the Krishna conscious movement, like we had a sporting activities on Saturday or Sunday, whatever it is, then the kids would actually feel more part of the society. So there's certain times when you can utilize sporting activities. But generally, if you get too much in it, you're watching all these games on TV, that means you're in Maya, I'm sorry to say. There's no question about it. So anyway, these are all mode of ignorance types of things. Intoxication, meeting, gambling, Kali Yuga stuff. So people in Kali Yuga are Shudras. And Shudras are attracted to those things. And therefore, if you want a Shudra to do something, you just dangle the carrot in front of them. And not only, of course, you offer them, these illicit things, but any type of sense gratification. That's all you have to do to manipulate a shudra. You just offer them sense gratification, food, the belly, illicit, sex, attractive women. I mean, it's a very easy thing to manipulate shudras, because shudras basically don't think for themselves. They play follow the leader. Just like we had this game when we were young, follow the leader. So, as a result, they blindly follow. And just like this psychologist who did this study, what was his name who did this shock study? Do you remember?
Yeah,
you don't remember it.
I can't remember.
You don't remember his name.
No, it wasn't Skinner.
Skinner was a behavioral therapist, but I forget the person's name. Anyway, so he was doing this study to see, because he was concerned thinking about World War II. That's actually what stimulated the whole study. In World War II, you had, of course, Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, and people just blindly followed. They sort of snapped into what the psychologists called a herd mentality. It's very interesting, because that's a part of the lower nature of people. Herd mentality means, like, if you see a cow and the cows all follow the leader, in every herd of cows there's always a leader. The leader doesn't have to be the male. Sometimes the leader is a female, if it's just cows. And the cows, they go in a nice little file out to one pasture, then a certain time of the day they come to another pasture, and when someone rings the bell, it's time for hay or whatever, the cows come back. But they follow the leader, so this is called the herd mentality, which is part of the lower nature of people. I mean, this has also been analyzed by psychologists. So during World War II, of course, many people, maybe it's the majority, blindly followed. I mean, a few people actually elected not to follow, and they were great heroes. They were saving some of the Jewish people that were being persecuted. So psychologist wanted to understand this particular dynamic. He said, and actually, after the war, when they had these different trials to see who was guilty, the prison camp commandants or the people who worked in the prison camp who tortured people, they said their excuse was, I was simply following orders, right? Simply following orders. I'm not responsible for it. But still, they were held responsible, if they tortured people. So this psychologist did this test. He said, well, let's see if people will act like that nowadays. And so he was calling for volunteers from the university or from the neighboring area who would operate this shocking device. And the shocking device would have different levels of voltage. At least the labels were there for different levels of voltage, beginning with 10 volts, 20 volts, 30 volts, 50 volts, all the way up to, I think, 400 and something volts, which would have been fatal to people. You shock people with direct current.
Milgram?
What?
Is that Stanley Milgram?
Milgram, yeah. Thank you. You find that on the internet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Google. That was Milgram's experiment. So, anyway, so he said, so you're going to be, these volunteers, he said, you're going to be the instructor. We're testing learning techniques. And there'll be a person in another room. You'll be connected with them, be able to hear what they say. And they'll be the learner. And they're going to be given certain questions. And if they answer the question right, you don't shock them. If they answer the question wrong, you give them a shock. And so they said, yes, yes, yes. Of course, the person in the other room who was getting the shocks, or the learner, was not actually a volunteer. He was working for the doctor, Milgram. And the person who was going to be getting the shocks wasn't actually going to get shocks. He was just going to act like he was getting the shocks to see how far the person who is the examiner, the person operating the machine, would go before he just said, no more, I'm not going to do this anymore. Because at a certain level, the shocks would be extremely dangerous. And even at the beginning, they're painful. I mean, even you had a 10-volt, 20-volt, 50, what if you go 50-volt shock? And so anyway, so the person who was supposed to be getting the shocks or wasn't getting the shocks acted as if he was getting the shocks. So most of the volunteers went all the way up to the top. Even though the person who was supposed to get in the shots was screaming and yelling, "You're killing me. What are you doing?" And they went all the way up to 450 volts. And basically the person sometimes acted like he was dead. There was absolute silence. But one of the things that encouraged the volunteer to go all the way to the top is that when the volunteer had some doubts about the test, he would look at the professor, Mr. Milgram, and the professor would say, "I'm taking responsibility for this. I'm responsible." And so they would turn back to the machine and keep pushing the levers and taking it all the way up to the highest voltage. So they really neglected their responsibility. That's a symptom of Shudra. The Shudra does not think independently. Prabhupada wanted independent, thoughtful devotees. Prabhupada also said in the Bhagavad Gita, blind following absurd inquiries are to be condemned. So we don't really want people like that. Although we do have an authority structure, which is really interesting. I mean, there's many aspects to the Vedic authority structure. One thing I was thinking about when reading this particular verse was the injunctions referring to how the wife should follow the husband. You know, you have the chaste wife. Of course, the husband doesn't have to be chaste. He can be a devotee, but I'm speaking facetiously. But you have the chaste wife, and I was just reading in seventh canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where Narada's instructions in human society describing what a chaste wife does. And she should follow the husband, you know, serve the husband, all these things. And you read about in the Mahabharata, when Draupadi was asked about her qualities of being a chaste wife, she said, "I would wake up earlier than my husbands, and go to sleep later than my husbands, and never say a harsh word to my husbands." And so you hear all these injunctions, but at the end of this particular description in the seventh canto, it stated, the chaste wife should serve the husband who is not fallen. In other words, if a husband is fallen or if a leader is fallen, it's even a wife's responsibility. I'm not trying to discourage anyone here, because I think everybody has good husbands here. But it's the wife's responsibility to basically live separately. Not, of course, to, you know, run away and become a prostitute, as Prabhupada says in the purport in the seventh canto, but to actually live separately and doesn't have to follow the husband anymore, which is, you know, it's really interesting. Of course, that was brought out in the pastime, Lord Chaitanya's pastime of when he went to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's house to take prasadam. And so when he went to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's house to take prasadam, he was eating quite a bit of prasadam. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had a son-in-law named Amoga. And Amoga, he had a tendency to criticize. Actually, it's interesting that you see that even during Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, there were people who had a tendency to criticize, like Ramchandra Puri, Amoga. I mean, it's not at all uncommon. So even Lord Chaitanya had to be subjected to it, so don't complain if you have to be subjected to criticism. So anyway, so Amoga, he was trying to find fault with Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was taking prasadam, and Amoga was trying to see how much Lord Chaitanya was taking. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was sort of standing there with a stick to keep Amoga away, but when he was inattentive, Amoga was looking, and he said, "This sannyasi is eating as much as 10 men," which was actually true, because Lord Chaitanya would eat a lot. And then Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya got so angry, because Lord Chaitanya laughed at the whole thing, he thought it was inconsequential. And then Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya got so angry, he started chasing Amoga with a stick. And he, you know, running, ready to kill Amoga, because Amoga was quite younger than Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. So Amoga was able to escape. But Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was so upset that he and his wife declared at that moment that their daughter, Sati, was a widow. In other words, she had no husband. That's interesting. I mean, in the Vedic system, you know, this is highly unusual for a wife to say, "I have no husband," or "I'm a widow," when the husband is still alive. Of course, even being a widow was actually a heavy thing. I was just talking to my mother last night, and she had to fill out some form. and they asked her what her ashram was. They didn't use the word ashram, of course. But, you know, her status, you know, single, married, divorced, whatever. And she, you know, it struck her when she had to actually tick or check. We say check here in India, in America, but in India they say tick. So you had to check this box that said widow, so it's just very heavy. So Sati had to become a widow, or was declared to be a widow, because her husband was fallen and had criticized Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which is quite interesting. But of course later on, Amoga, he contracted cholera very quickly after that. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saved him. Amoga started chanting Hare Krishna and became situated again in the rightful position. And then Sati, I guess, accepted Amoga back as her husband. So the point is that even in such a relationship as husband and wife, or like guru, disciple, or any of these relationships that are considered so essential in the Vedic system, or so important in the Vedic system, a blind following is not advocated. So how to avoid, the question is, how to avoid following blindly? And the way I have, or the way I'm recommending to avoid following blindly, in Krishna consciousness, we're not going to speak about the material world in general, but in Krishna consciousness, the way is to actually study very intensely Srila Prabhupada's books and to develop a very, very good sense of discrimination. Prabhupada said discrimination is the better part of valor. Discrimination means the intelligence. Now, we have intelligence and we have a mind. The mind accepts and rejects things based upon pretty much what pleases us or what displeases us. I mean, for example, one who is functioning on the basis of the mind would be accepting a spiritual master based upon just like charisma or something like that. You know, because it's not that everybody who has charisma is necessarily spiritual. And of course, someone has charisma, could be spiritual or could not be. I mean, it's not really that important. Some of the most spiritual people in the world, great pure devotees, may not have much charisma. And some absolute demons may have a lot. I'm sure Ravana had a lot of charisma. I mean, even the ladies he kidnapped, they loved him. I mean, even though he had this curse that he couldn't force himself upon the lady, but, you know, basically once upon a time when he did kidnap the ladies, you know, after the initial shock. Ravan. After the initial shock, you know, you're kidnapped, there's a little shocking, a little traumatic, but then you look and you see this handsome guy, you know, who's worth billions of dollars, has a giant palace, you can have anything you want. I mean, practically any of the ladies here would probably just jump at the chance. Run away with Robin. Anyway, I mean, he had a lot of good qualities. He wasn't just doing bad things. He was chanting mantras nicely, very handsome, and everything like that. So, anyway, getting back to the point, we have to really develop the intelligence, because the mind, as Krishna describes in the Gita, is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. You know, we follow the mind, accepting and rejecting. That's what the mind does, based upon what appeals to you. I mean, just like if I look at some food, for example, a lot of food will appeal to me that's not good for me. A lot of food. We're not even talking about, you know, leaders or misleaders. You know, I can look at like a pile of lubjimins. And I can say the mind says, wow, let's go for it. But then the intelligence, even we're talking about the material platform now, the intelligence says, hey, you're 65 years old. You did that when you were young. What is it going to do to you now? How will it impede your service? How will it impede your health? You know, what is the long-term, you know, we're talking about the difference between Shreyas and Prayas. You understand? Shreyas means actually, you know, the immediate stuff, you know. And Shreyas means, you know, long term. Of course, there's different definitions for the two words, but These are the definitions that Prabhupada usually used. Shreyas and prayas. You know, immediately satisfaction, or shreyas, long-term satisfaction. So the mind is thinking like any of us. I mean, I have to be honest, my mind thinks like that too when I see a plate of Gulab Jamuns or pizza pie or something like that, or any of these things. But then the intelligence kicks in. There's a habit. You know, intelligence kicks in and says, even if it's, hopefully it hasn't come to the point of feeling. You know, there's thinking, feeling, willing, which are the three stages of the mind. You think about it, yeah, it would be nice. But then if you start to feel it, then you become like the Pavlovian dogs that are salivating. And then you will it, and then, you know, at that point, it becomes harder and harder to control as it goes up to thinking, feeling, willing, a hierarchy. And so you've really got to have the intelligence kick in immediately and say, would Krishna be pleased? Would this be good for my health? Would this be good for devotional service? And if the answer is no, then you do the exercise called push away. Instead of push-ups, you push away. So that's really what we have to do. We have to really examine things with our intelligence, make our intelligence really strong to be stable and steady in Krishna consciousness, because these pushings and pullings will come. And every minute we should examine, is this going to be productive spiritually, materially, for my goals in life? And it's 24 hours a day we have to be alert. I mean, sometimes, like, I catch myself on the computer, you know, just spending too much time, you know, called internet addiction. Too much time on the computer, because you can, like, Google this and then random jump to this, random jump to that. I mean, it's like a type of subtle sense enjoyment, isn't it? I mean, it is. I catch myself getting caught up in that. And I said, no, you have service. You have this to do, that to do, that to do. You can't waste Krishna's time. So that's really the point. Then we won't get misled either by the mind. The mind is also a misleader. We're not just talking about people. I mean, practically we get misled by our mind more than we get misled by people. But in any circumstance, we could examine. So as far as picking a spiritual master or picking an authority or a leader, we must be extremely careful. Of course, the Vedic literature contains injunctions or standards, like the famous verse, Samit Pani Shrutim Brahmanishtam. Someone must be fixed in Krishna consciousness. Someone must be a servant of a spiritual master. Shrutim must have heard nicely from the spiritual master. I mean, there's so many different injunctions, Vaishnava qualities, that we should examine practically to see if we want to accept someone as a leader. But even when we accept someone as a leader, then we still have to be examining the instructions so as not to either misinterpret or blindly follow. So anyway, these are important things. Otherwise, surprisingly enough, we will go to hell with whoever is misleading us, and we can't blame him. We really want to give up our own personal responsibility. That's really the point. That we're giving up our own personal responsibility, not taking responsibility for our actions. I mean, sometimes we even blame Maya. You say, you know, why can't you control your senses? Well, I'm in Maya. Huh? I know you're in Maya, but you're blaming Maya. You understand? Then you pull out another verse. Dharachya, Mama Maya Dharachya. Krishna's Maya is impossible to overcome, so how do you expect me to overcome it? So it's all this blaming, or as we say in empathic communication, denial of responsibility. You know, we are denying our responsibility. So basically, what this verse here is advocating, we should take responsibility for our choices, actions, who we follow, even what we eat, what our schedule is, what we do during the day, you know, or what we're addicted to, what we're giving up. You know, it means full responsibility as adults. I mean, children are different. But adults have to take full responsibility for their lives. So anyway, on that happy note, we'll leave some time over for questions. Yes?
This is a hot topic.
Yeah.
But, But if one sees that his or her spiritual master is not really up to par, and that doing strange things, and I'm not talking about openly sinful activities, just not quite following the process.
Can you give us an example of a strange things?
For example, minimizing the scriptures or the Swamis.
The Vedic injunction is one should go to the Guru and reveal one's mind in confidence. There's other things, going to the Guru's God brothers and asking the Guru's God brothers to approach the Guru. And if the Guru isn't irretrievably fallen, he's not given up. But you pray, one takes shelter of other Sikh Gurus and then prays for the, one prays for the Guru. It's not that one, if the Guru has become an offender, this is Narahari Chakravarti talks about this. It was in his Krishna Bhajanamrita, that if the Guru is, hopelessly fallen, becomes an offender and things like that, then the Guru is rejected and given up. But if it's a question of judgment, yeah. If some details like that, then one has to try. Just like if the wife sees the husband do something that's not really up to snuff, hate to use that expression, then she should try to help the husband, pray to the husband, remain chaste to the husband. In other words, we don't give up our relationship so easily. It's just not appropriate, but we can take help. Like in a family, the wife can take help from other family members. So we have so many family members we can take help from in ISKCON, yeah.
I understand the idea of helping, and at the same time I think that it's like becoming the guru of your guru. You know what I'm saying? And I don't think that's proper.
Well,
Nothing
to become the guru, you reveal your mind and confidence to the spiritual master about the doubts you have. I wouldn't say giving him guidance. I would say revealing your mind and going to other God brothers who can approach him etiquette-wise. Yeah, but the point you're making is very good. There's an etiquette. It's not you go to Guru Dev. You are a maya. Guru Dev, you're wrong. You are off the wall. Guru on the wall. When are you going to fall? Anyway, so it's not that you do that. But, you reveal your mind, and if you're not, he's not able to take it, because, sometimes when we have a high position, it's hard to take instructions, even though we should. Then you go to the God brothers and other senior members who can etiquette-wise deal with it, and you reveal your mind to them. I mean, there's a way to do it without breaking the etiquette. Yeah, you don't become the guru, you guru. Yes, you.
I was going to, it's slightly in line with this. Is it possible to be in Krishna conscious movement and seemingly being primarily right, still be at the level of blind following? Or
yes.
In other words, you're doing everything right, but you're not thinking.
Yeah, that's right. Because
people listening online too, they can't
hear. All right, that's a good point. Christopher asks, is it possible to be in the Krishna conscious movement doing everything right, in other words, following the orders of the Guru, doing everything right, but following blindly? Yes, because one is supposed to be executing devotional service with the subtle body too. That's actually the most important thing. Prabhupada mentions that devotional service is executed with the subtle body. The gross body follows around. We're not supposed to be robots. And the whole point of bhakti yoga, according to Rupa Goswami, that everything you do should be done how Krishna wants it, actively, and also with a spirit of devotion, with intelligence, like that, not niyamagraha. Niyamagraha is actually one of the faults in devotional service according to Jiva Rupa Goswami also. That Niyamagraha means just following blindly without a spiritual intention, you know, just following. So one has to really be examining even the instructions given from the guru and not following blindly. Prabhupada made that point in that story, don't have time to tell it, where Prabhupada was talking about told the devotees in the future we'll have so many big dogs in the Krishna consciousness movement. And the devotees said, Jai Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, you know, anything I say you'll accept. This is, you know, Prabhupada rejected that sort of following at that point. So Prabhupada said we need independently thoughtful people. Not violating the etiquette. I mean, there's a fine line, you know, you don't want to violate etiquette and say, Gurudev, you know, you're wrong, you have the wrong strategy, but at the same time thoughtful enough to approach and say, reveal one's mind and confidence. I mean, the guru should be ready to hear someone revealing the mind and confidence. That's one of the qualities of the guru. I mean, if the guru is going to just like blast you to hell, just because you reveal, if you go to the guru and say, can I reveal your mind? And the guru says, your mind is useless anyway. What the hell are you going to reveal to me? Then what's that relationship? Isn't it? Yeah, I mean...